I'm Annie Corrigan, and this is Earth Eats.
The distinctive thing about persimmon tree is that the bark is shaped like tiles, it said. You know, so the striations go up and down, but they also go sideways, kind of splitting it into little pieces.
Louise Briggs has a huge persimmon tree in her backyard, and it's already dropping fruit. We talked to her about the joys and struggles that come with her giving tree. From Harvest Public Media, growers are introducing good bugs as a way of fighting off bad bugs. Then in the kitchen, another recipe to add to your book for times when you have way too many tomatoes. Food and farming news, here's Mark.
There's an old German proverb, "Alles ist seinen Preis wert." That means everything is worth what its purchaser will pay for it. Perhaps German pharmaceutical company Bayer AG should share that proverb with Monsanto, as Monsanto rejects their third buyout offer since May. The German pharmaceutical and crop chemical company is now offering $65 million, or $127.50 a share, to acquire Monsanto, a 2% increase on its previous offer. Bayer has twice sweetened the deal for the St. Louis-based seed company, even throwing in a $1.5 billion antitrust breakup fee. While that 2% increase didn't lead to a deal, it was enough for Monsanto to at least agree to open its books to Bayer for due diligence checks on the business, a primary point of contention in the company's past talks. Some analysts expect Monsanto to hold out for an offer somewhere between $130 and $135 a share. A disease that has damaged corn has been confirmed in the U.S. for the first time. As Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports, it appears to be spreading in the heart of the corn belt.
It's called bacterial leaf streak of corn, and it looks like it sounds, yellow streaks down the leaves of the plant. It's been found on sugarcane in many countries and on corn in South Africa, but samples submitted by farmers in Nebraska were the first cases identified in American cornfields. University of Nebraska plant pathologist Tamara Jackson-Zims is following its progress.
We know this disease has occurred on corn in other states, especially some of the ones bordering Nebraska and a few others in the Corn Belt in the central United States.
Jackson-Zims says severe infections may hurt corn yield, but researchers aren't sure how much. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
And at first glance, seaweed seems like the perfect aquaculture product. It's easy to grow and requires no fertilizer. It reaps economic benefits for producers and health benefits for consumers. Seaweed also helps combat global warming by soaking up carbon dioxide from the air. It's no wonder business is booming, with China, South Korea, Indonesia, and the Philippines leading the seaweed surge. Around 27 tons of seaweed was produced on farms in 2014, making the crop worth $6.4 billion. But a new report from the UN University says global seaweed production needs tighter regulations to avoid further economic and ecological damage. The report shows little regulation in many nations and growing concern for the spread of pests and pathogens that disrupt ecological balance. The UN University report recommends several measures to help curb the negative effects of seaweed farming, like preserving seaweed stocks, seed banks, and government-sponsored insurance to abate natural disasters like typhoons.
More about these stories and other stories that don't make it into the headlines at eartheats.org. A big thanks to our man Mark Chilla.
No problem.
There's an age-old quiet struggle on farm fields, farmers versus pests. To ward off intruding insects and noxious weeds, many farmers turn to chemical pesticides, but they can damage the environment. That's why some producers are turning to an alternative, more natural pest control option, Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports.
From the get-go, Gary Wenig wanted to produce organic vegetables. He bought 40 acres in central Missouri with his wife to do just that.
This was all hayfield, so we had a serious problem with weeds since we don't spray, and a lot of pests.
Going organic means the Wenigs can't use man-made pesticides. No Roundup, no atrazine. Organic farmers can use natural pesticides, but they're expensive and still can be dangerous. So Wenig decided to try an experiment. He planted trap crops, sacrificial plants that are extra tasty for pesky insects like squash bugs. So they'll flock to the Blue Hubbard squash and leave his zucchinis alone.
The bugs will move in, they will stop at that point and eat those plants. So then you spray that portion of your garden only, you don't have to spray the food that you're eating.
But Wenig took it even further. He wanted to cut out all pesticides.
Come on, girls. Come on.
My concept was, well, we have free-range chickens, and the chickens love those bugs. Instead of spraying at all, why don't we get the chickens to eat them?
Not only does it save Wenig money on pesticides, it saves money on feed for his chickens and ducks.
That's right. Chickens love bugs. That's where the saying, chicken on a June bug, came from.
Of course, you need many more birds to take care of uninvited bugs in larger, more conventional farms. That's where predatory bugs come in handy. Ben Putler is a professor emeritus of entomology at the University of Missouri-Columbia.
If you take the soybean aphid right now, it's considered a pest because they don't have its natural enemies. And we're trying to introduce natural enemies for it.
The tiny soybean aphid comes from Asia and sucks the juices out of the plant, which can lead to fungus and mold. The bugs trash nearly half of a farmer's crops in some studies. Putler says the aphid popped up in the U.S. around 2000. Enter the parasitic wasp.
You can look at it this way if you want to. We have an army, and the wasps are the Air Force, and the ground force are the predators.
The wasps inject their eggs into aphids. The larvae then eat the aphid from the inside out before emerging as an adult wasp. Researchers are testing natural predators for other agricultural pests too, including stink bugs and the infamous emerald ash borer that's been devastating to ash trees all over the country. But sometimes it's the plant itself that is bugging farmers. Weeds can send an organic farmer running for help, especially if it's an unfamiliar weed, like the invasive garlic mustard.
It is very easy to pull out. The problem is there's just so many of them.
Hank Stelzer is a forestry specialist with University of Missouri Extension. He says garlic mustard comes from Europe and has been creeping into the Midwest pastures and forests for several years now. The weed stops grass and tree seedlings from starting, making it harder for grazing pastures and timber forests to reproduce. Researchers are currently testing a few weevil species and tiny wasps that love to chow down on garlic mustard.
They will both suck the life, if you will, out of the plant, but that's also where they lay their eggs, and so they get more of those critters out there.
Stelzer says that's why the U.S. Department of Agriculture conducts rigorous tests in quarantined labs.
It's like the controlled environment. The greenhouses that they're in, the growth chambers they're in, there are a number of fail-safe mechanisms.
Regulatory approval can take decades. For farmer Gary Wenig, next year he plans to expand his trap crop perimeter to encompass all of his garden plots, including the high tunnel.
And we're going to just plant nothing in there but sacrificial plants, beneficial insect plants.
Lure the bugs away from the moneymakers and then let the chickens have at it. There are still some weed species Wenig has trouble with, though.
We haven't found anything organic that kills bindweed, so as soon as we come up with some of that, we'll be in pretty good shape.
In the future, Wenig plans to use his farm to teach his technique to others interested in going the chemical-free route. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Seems to me like persimmons start to fall earlier and earlier. You notice that? They've been plummeting from Louise Briggs's backyard tree for over a week already. She's constructed an elaborate net to catch the little orange globes before they hit the ground.
Doesn't it silent once it hits the net? The adorable sound is it hitting leaves as it goes down. Yeah. What is that? Pinball machine. My persimmon pinball machine.
I met Louise last year, and we talked about the agony and the ecstasy of sharing her backyard with a 60-foot persimmon tree. Louise and her husband Bob moved to southern Indiana in the winter of 2010. They were hunting for a house to buy.
And the realtor said to me, and there's a persimmon tree in the backyard, too. I'm from Boston. What do I know from persimmons, you know? So we just went about our business, went through the winter, and when it came towards spring, I decided I should start looking up persimmons, you know, and see what kind of tree this was. And so the distinctive thing about persimmon trees is that the bark is shaped like tiles, it said, you know, so the striations go up and down, but they also go sideways, kind of splitting it into little pieces. Springtime, I was out, you know, cleaning up the yard and stuff. I said, well, let me just look around and see which of these trees is the persimmon tree, because there were lots of trees in the yard. So I went from tree to tree. No, not that one. No, not that one. No, not that one. And I looked at the big one right in the middle of the yard, and I thought, surely not that one. So I walked over to the tree and looked at the bark, and it was totally perfect. It was picture perfect. Looked just like the pictures in the book.
The previous owners had just let the fruit fall and rot on the ground, killing all the grass around the tree. When the persimmons started falling in late summer, Louise and Bob quickly realized that that wasn't a good option for them.
We knew we had to net them because over the course of a few weeks, my little dog became a pudgy little dog, and I kept cutting back on his food thinking I'm feeding him too much. And then we realized, we looked out in the back, and when we put him out, he'd be out there eating persimmons, which are high calorie, and he was having a good time.
She spent a couple of hours every day collecting persimmons from the net in 10-gallon bins. She removed the caps and cleaned off the leaves. It was a chore. Every couple of weeks, she would throw a perpetual persimmon pulping party where friends would help her process the fruit into 2-cup bags. That year's haul, by the numbers, almost 40 10-gallon bins of fruit harvested, processed into 108 2-cup portions. Last year, Louise put the call out to locals. Free persimmons to anyone willing to put the work in.
Come on, come on
out. Hello,
about a dozen community members met at her house for that first persimmon party. Louise gave a tutorial on using the net, pushed the persimmons from the various parts of the net to the center, then pull down two of the poles to reveal a hole in the net.
So just go under. Push it on over. When you get to the edge.
Oh, it smells so good.
Drop it down a little.
Look at that.
There they go.
It's almost
pudding.
Then
you get the next bunch.
These persimmons are perfect, squishy and a dark orange. In the kitchen, we take turns pulling off the caps and rinsing the fruit.
It's very, very sweet and delicious. And the dark ones are caramelized and perfect. These are awesome.
Once they're cleaned, it's over to Louise's motorized food mill.
So this is your high-tech lesson.
The ooze comes out one side, the seeds and the skins splurt out the other.
I know, it's fabulous.
Isn't it beautiful?
That's even worse, yes.
That day, everyone left with some pulp for making pudding, bread, and donut glaze. There's plenty more where this came from, Louise says. Every day, for the next several weeks, someone from the community will come and take her persimmons away. And Louise couldn't be happier. I couldn't help but ask, do you regret buying this house with this tree and the responsibility that comes with it?
I won't say that I haven't had moments. But no, I would miss it. I would really miss it.
And then swish, swish, swish goes another persimmon pinball plummeting from the tree down to the net. Louise's persimmon posse is already at it this year. I think she said something like 5 bins of persimmons fell from her tree the other day. If you find yourself with a plethora of persimmon pulp, go over to eartheats.org and search for persimmons to find lots of recipe ideas. We're also all about listener-submitted recipes. Do that with an email to eartheats@gmail.com. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated. Now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. and from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb, taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. Annie Corrigan here for Earth Eats. Hello. Alexis Daly has food allergies. When she was young, she felt isolated because she didn't have a support group of kids her age who were also dealing with food allergies. She recently spoke with several young kids today who are able to look on the bright side of their struggles, in part because they have each other.
Growing up with a food allergy isn't easy.
Sunflower seeds, evaporated cane syrup, milled cane sugar, salt.
We read every label and carry an EpiPen and Benadryl wherever we go. But there are 50% more children with allergies now than when I was little, during the late 90s. When I was their age, I didn't know anyone else.
Yeah, when I get home from work, the first thing I have to do is get a Clorox wipe and wipe down my phone.
Wendy Taylor is a mother of four kids with food allergies. You heard one of them, Miranda, reading a label at the top of this piece. Wendy says this makes seemingly simple tasks much more involved, especially since three of her children are in the growing population of people with multiple airborne allergies. As we drive to their house, she explains what it's like for our family to go grocery shopping.
So we grab a cart, we wipe down the cart, and then wipe down our hands, and then we do our grocery shopping, and then read every label every time. You know, things change. And then put it all in the car, and then get it home, and wipe it all down again.
Reactions vary, but usually include hives and trouble breathing, which can be deadly. This is Miranda again.
I read every label, even if it comes in the house, I read every label that I eat.
Next to their food pantry is a whiteboard with a chart of each family member's name and a list of allergens. It's 1 foot long and wide and reminds me of an extremely intense bingo playing card. When each kid said their allergies,
peanuts,
egg, peanut, rye,
I'm allergic to egg.
Brussels sprouts,
parsley, paprika,
nuts, tree nuts,
egg, peanut, rye.
I couldn't help but feel grateful that I only had an allergy to nuts. It seemed like such a big hassle when I was little, but it's nothing compared to this.
Did I say peanuts?
But the Taylor kids, their views kind of surprised me. They aren't really scared. This is Audrey.
I watched the movie Soul Surfer, and I take my allergies as a learning opportunity and an opportunity to help other people. So, and to give them advice, like a friend just came to the allergy table with new allergies. So, yeah, I kind of wonder what it would be like, the opportunities that I would have. But I mean, my family takes care of me, and we do things our own way. I mean, it's kind of fun.
They have separate allergy-friendly tables at schools, as well as support groups for the parents. This is the Hitchcock family. They're in the same support group with the Taylors. Like the Taylor kids, Zach and Abby understand allergies are serious, but having done this their whole lives gives them confidence. This is 8-year-old Abby.
You have to be careful with them. And it's kind of hard for kids with food allergies, so...
Why is it hard?
Because you have to be making sure that everything you eat is safe and that you won't get an allergic reaction, because it isn't fun.
Her brother Zach, a fifth grader who's allergic to dairy, eggs, soy, and all types of nuts, has a different take.
Having a food allergy also sort of brings me special talents, like being able to sing really well, play guitar, and dance to Michael Jackson. I can do the moonwalk, just saying.
I have to admit, I'm a little jealous. And I think what I've learned from this is that community can significantly transform an otherwise frustrating and scary situation into, for Audrey, a chance to help people, or, for Zach, special talents like a super cool dance move. For Earth Eats, I'm Alexis Daly.
We work with students like Alexis from Indiana University's Media School. Thanks to Sarah Neal Estes for help with this and with other student stories. Hear more of these young journalists at eartheats.org. The craft beer boom has local breweries springing up everywhere, but at least one crucial ingredient isn't local to the Midwest. Most of the nation's hops are grown in the Pacific Northwest. But as Ariana Brocious reports for Harvest Public Media, that may be starting to change.
Beer is made from four basic ingredients: water, malt, yeast, and hops.
Hops are perennial. They can last up to 35 years once planted.
Annette Wiles of Midwest Hop Producers shows off a plant at her two-year-old hop yard in Plattsmouth, Nebraska, close to the Iowa border. They've planted 23 different hop varieties on their three-acre test plot.
Our goal is to see what grows well in Nebraska, what's disease-resistant, drought-resistant, and pest-resistant.
Brewers use hops for bittering, aroma, and flavor. Right now, nearly all U.S. hops are grown in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. But as the craft beer craze has been sweeping the nation, farmers in other regions want in on the action.
However, our environment in these Midwest areas is totally different than where hops is typically grown.
That's University of Nebraska-Lincoln researcher Stacy Adams. He's also been testing which hop varieties will do best in Nebraska, using four test plots around the state with different microclimates and soil types.
Given our environment is somewhat volatile, we want to identify varieties that the farmer will be able to market, because the brewers are mainly looking for this consistency from year to year to year.
Universities in Michigan, Minnesota, Ohio, and Iowa are also investing in research and training for this new specialty crop. Local farmers are starting to grow hop vines. That's vine with a B. But Mark Pattison says commercial hop growing can be daunting.
One, it costs about $12,000 an acre to put them in. Two is you don't get a good, profitable crop for 3 years. And three is the labor. Compared to other crops, it's very labor intensive.
He started Buck Creek Hops 2 years ago in south central Iowa and is now the biggest grower in the state. Though the region's humidity can be a challenge, thanks to copious sunlight, Pattison says the Midwest is actually ripe for growing hops.
Obviously, everyone's looking for alternative crops with commodity prices so low. If you're between the 35th and 55th parallel, you're in a good area, and we're at the 46th here.
Pattison is betting that Iowa has a good shot at competing on the hops market. Farming is at the state's core, and he says the flavor of a Cascade hop, for example, is pretty much the same.
Every type of soil, every farm will have a little bit different kind of aroma, but in general, like a Cascade's a Cascade. We can produce the same hops they can.
Startup costs of industrial-scale equipment is a big reason why there aren't more large-scale hop farms in the Midwest. Midwest Hop Producers is investing millions of dollars to build the first commercial hops processing facility in Nebraska. They recently bought a huge harvester from Germany. They'll handle their own hops and those from other growers, too. The delicate hop cones, which are harvested at around 80% moisture, have to be handled right to maximize the qualities brewers want. Wiles leads the way into their drying room, as hot and muggy as a sauna.
Just similar to coffee beans, if you dry them too hot, too fast, you'll burn the oils and then you've ruined your crop.
Currently, most Midwest hop growers are small-scale hobbyists who sell wet hops fresh off the vine to breweries in the fall. But to supply breweries on a large scale year-round, hops have to be dried, milled, and turned into the pellet hops brewers prefer. Kim Cavillac, co-founder of Nebraska Brewing Company, is looking forward to a large-scale supply of local hops in the future.
We do see a future of that. We're really, really excited about that part of the industry growing.
And Cavillac says they'll partner on the brewing side as local hop producers continue to develop.
We'll do test batches and make sure that what they're using is either A, compatible with what we're already doing, or develop some other recipes that are compatible with the hops that they're growing.
So while most Nebraska beer is still made from hops from far away, a whole new kind of local craft beer may soon be on tap. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Ariana Brocious.
So, you go out to your garden to see your tomato plants absolutely flourishing. So many gorgeous red ripe tomatoes that are begging to be picked right now. But you've already made a batch of tomato sauce to put away for the winter, and the salsa is already in jars. And come on, you can only eat so many caprese salads. So here's another way to process a whole bunch of tomatoes all at once. with Chef Daniel Orr.
So today on Earth Eats, we've got a very simple recipe. We love to do things simply. We're going to do roasted tomatoes. Okay, and that sounds as simple as it is. So we're going to do this. We've got some Italian plum tomatoes, which are a little bit meatier. They have a little bit less seeds and less of the kind of the jelly inside the tomatoes. And these are what would be used typically in an Italian tomato sauce or that kind of thing because they have much more body. I'm just going to take 5 or 6 tomatoes, cut them into quarters, and then whatever else you have around. I love to put some fresh oregano, fresh basil, kind of those Tuscan flavored herbs. And but if you want, over here I've got a whole plethora of herbs. I've got some homegrown green onions. I've got some fennel. And we're just going to chop those up finely. Take out most of the big stems. All right, so then I'm going to grab a French knife, which is kind of the all-purpose knife. If you are an amateur cook that really wants to invest in some good equipment, it's knives and pots and pans. That's what you want to invest in. You don't need to invest in a bunch of those little trinkets and little gadgets that you see on late night TV. They aren't expensive, but they aren't good either. Okay, we're also going to slice up some garlic, actually. Just slice it as thin as you can. Garlic is really to taste. I'm using about 8 cloves of garlic, so almost, more than a clove per tomato, but that's just the way I like it. All right, and to that we're going to add a little bit of salt and pepper, teaspoon of each, and some oil. And we're just going to toss those. I'm just going to put these back out on a cookie sheet. Spread them out. And sometimes people like to put a little bit of sugar or honey with them, and that's just going to intensify the sweetness. If it tastes like it's a little bland, you want a little more acidity, just throw in a couple teaspoons of white vinegar, and that's going to build that nice acid that we expect to taste in a tomato. All right, these go in the oven. Roast them for 15 to 20 minutes until they're starting to caramelize. When you pull them out, there's that nice oil in there, the juices have come out, the fresh herbs have kind of melded into the tomatoes.
Daniel serves these as side dishes for all of his brunch recipes. Some crackers and goat cheese would be just right, too. You can tweak this recipe slightly to do an indoor version of sun-dried tomatoes if you like. It's basically a lower temperature on the oven and roasting the tomatoes for a lot longer. Lots of recipes at eartheats.org. In the kitchen, we have support from photographer Eabon Binder, who's lucky enough to get to taste every one of Daniel's recipes with me. Writing for our website is Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow. Our executive producer is John Bailey. And a shout out, of course, to the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal. Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. And from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie Corrigan. Bye-bye.